Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Gather Round. I'm Ruthanna from KCO, and tonight we have our Bits and Bobs. We've got Manuel Fernandez, who died, and he's still here over two decades later. And then Sarit Jacobson is coming in. So much is going on in the Palestine-Israeli, confrontation mess. So we'll be talking about those things. I wanted to start out with saying that, you know, we're talking about the simple life and simplifying. And part of that would be to lessen our pollution. Well, the World Health Organization just came out with a list of the 10 most polluted cities in the world. And New Delhi is one. Actually, 6 out of the top 10 are in India. The next 3 are, and then there's 3 in Pakistan and 1 in Iran. So, you know, we hear about the cities in China and other Southeast Asian countries being polluted, but India right now is taking the ribbon, you know, one of those things that nobody wants to claim. But remember, there's so much we can do, and a big part of that is not giving in to consumerism. If you don't buy it, they won't make it. Corporations won't be able to slave the people, and people will get back to doing things they love. So it's all interconnected. I wanted to make mention for all the pagans listening and all the pagan-friendly or pagan-curious people, Morning Glory Zell crossed over into the Summerland yesterday at 5:42 Pacific time, where she lived. She was with Oberon Zell, who's been her husband for over 4 decades, and a lot of their students and good friends and significant others were there. That this was not a surprise. I mean, it's been being planned for, actually. And we thought last week there was some things on Facebook, and so everybody thought, oh my goodness, she's crossed over, but she didn't. But she finally did yesterday. So lots of good energy to those who are mourning her, and many, many thanks to the people who were able to gather around and make this crossing the kind we all would like to have. I did want to mention next week, the 17th of May, is National Day of Action on the Keystone XL. So check that out online. See what you can do in the area you live in, because there's something everyone can do. We know how harmful this is. And don't fall for the lies that you may have heard about how this is going to present so many more jobs. We know this is a lie, and, you know, even if it were to give a few jobs, which it will give a few, a very small number, but this is for the building, it's not for maintenance. So, you know, this is what we've been listening to now for months and months and months about the jobs. The government in their, what do I want to say, sneaky, underhanded, lying manner, talk about all the jobs created and how, you know, employment is up. What they don't tell you is a lot of these jobs are 15, 20 hours a week part-time jobs, which no one can live on. Let's get real. So, you know, don't fall for the lie about the Keystone XL. then you would have to ask yourself, are those the kind of jobs you would want anyway? Something that is going to endanger our world even more, put us all more at risk, because so many pipelines, we know, they break. We just don't hear about this. If you're watching or listening to mainstream media, there's so much that you are missing. Because this is out there. You have to search it out. You have to go to alternative media and then get online, search things out. If you live in an area where there's some type of big belching smoke horrid thing, or maybe, you know, species are dying off in your rivers, whether it's plant or animal, you know, maybe like locally you can search out and find somebody working in these plants who are brave enough to talk to you. It doesn't happen a lot, but it can. I mean, it has been known to happen. So, you know, try to find out, but don't take the word of corporations that own the government or the government as to what's really happening and how supposedly safe all of these things are. I wanted to say, getting back to simplifying, also, a lot of people are gardening now. People who in the past, it would never enter their mind. And what I find very exciting is there's a lot of community gardening going on. And mostly, I think that's in the larger towns, because smaller towns, more people have their own space anyway. Excuse me, chilly here. And so large cities all seem to have areas that have been deserted. I'm not talking about a new city where everything's brand new and it's been planned for. But the older cities, people move out, buildings fall down, buildings are condemned, torn down. Then you just have a lot or two there. And many people are turning these into community gardens. So gardening, whether it's on a community scale or whether it's on your balcony, is important. And I would suggest that you go to www.thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. This is a great site. They also have YouTube videos, tons. This is Joy Bard and Holly Bard, and they are in Wisconsin, obviously, Wisconsin Vegetable Gardeners, and they have four plots now in their own backyard, her sister's backyard, another family's members. I mean, they have three or four gardens that they themselves are taking care of. But this is home gardening, and they don't pretend to have all the answers, because a lot of what they're doing is still in the experimental stage too. But they've been doing this for several years now, and they do have a lot of answers. And in fact, they're doing a special series for first-time gardeners. So this might be something that you would like to check out. You know, there's not just them, there's so much information online. So whether you just want to grow some herbs in your window, or a few climbing plants on your balcony, or you've got a 20 by 20 plot in your backyard or front yard, or a huge, you know, half acre or several acres, check out the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com. But also, you know, put in your specific interests in your search engine, because some people just really don't care about growing anything except tomatoes, and they may grow 25 varieties. You know, that's great. I mean, there's very little you can't do with tomatoes, it seems. So, you know, you can specify what you want, or if you want tomatoes on balconies, there you go. There's just so much available. And don't let yourself get, scared, because when you start doing this, you're going to get so much information. You know, ideally, you would have the next door neighbor or your grandparents who have been doing this and know all about what they're talking, but we don't always have that choice. So going online, and the good thing then about going online too, you can find out some new ways your grandparents may not have known about, because they did something that worked for them, it always worked for them, and this is what they suggest. So don't discount what they're saying, but don't either take it as, well, this is the only way to do it, because that's just not so. We have many ways of doing things. And a lot of the fun of it all, at least I think, is to experiment. You know, so you don't have to have just the regular basic old, what do I want to say? Oh, green beans, peas, and I love both. But you can experiment. You can grow some quinoa. Try something different. Try a different kind of tomato. There's one, and the name of it slips my mind, but it looks almost like it has warts. It has all these little things all over. It's so amazing looking. But there's so many things. You can also go to rareseeds.com. This is a wonderful place in Missouri. They also have a store now in California somewhere. But this is a young couple, and all of this stuff is heirloom, and they actually go around the world getting different kinds of seeds. So, you know, you don't have to do something that might just appear boring to you. I mean, I do suggest that you grow some kind of leaf lettuce or leafy greens anyway, because they're so easy, and they come up so fast, and you can just have salads. But, you know, Don't neglect your green onions and your radishes and these basic things, but stretch out a little bit and get some other things going. Right now, I'm expecting a call from Manuel Fernandez, and I don't have him here. I'm going to see if we can reach him. So in the meantime, we're just going to do a little bit of Elevated Feet. Not a problem, no. I just want to say that your website is www.wolfbattle.com. And
right.
You might, before we get into tonight's topic, you want to just give a little bit about your Wolf Battle series, a little info?
Sure. The story is about a young Lakota Sioux. He's a clone. He's only 8 years old, but they've downloaded all the memories of his previous life. He died as an 80-year-old man. He was a genius. He was a diplomat, a warrior. He had a long and very full life. And all of those thoughts and memories just really mess with the mind of a small child. And the story is science fiction. It takes place in the year 2184. You know, it's got all the action, adventure, and fun. It's got a lot of nifty characters in there with very different they're very different personalities. They butt heads a lot. You've got one young child, Tony, who's 12 years old, and he's always cracking jokes, and he kind of seems to be okay with the idea that they're stranded on some weird unknown planet. another The other people aren't so wild about it, but he kind of keeps things light and humorous, moving along. And, you know, behind the whole thing is you know, a little bit of a heavy theme of here's this kid who his entire previous life he spent as an absolute atheist, and he's coming to terms with the idea that, you know, there might be more to the universe than his, you know, genius past led him to believe. There might be something more out there. Kind of deals with the ideas of life after death and soulmates, and you know, it's got a lot of heavy stuff kind of mixed in with all the fun and lightness and adventure.
Well, okay, that brings me. You're talking about the all the fun, of course, but before we get into you dying 2 decades ago, let me ask. Well, okay, I'll ask that later. I want to get this in order. Let's just go back to just saying that I'm sure that some of the things in this book have come out of experience. And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So could you tell us a bit about that experience? This was in the early 90s, I believe.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, as far as any heading towards the light or afterlife experiences, it's real disappointing there, I think, because I was probably on so much medication and anesthesia and stuff where they just want to keep the body functioning that, and I didn't experience those things then. Actually, my first out-of-body experience happened long before then when I was 13 years old. So I didn't need to go through that in order to experience the out-of-body situation. But I did come away with something that I felt was very life-changing at the time I had the accident. And, you know, briefly, basically, as this 20,000-pound machine kind of settled itself on my body and I could feel things breaking and internal organs burst inside of me, and I was in complete shock. I was almost like an outside observer, you know, looking at this and, you know, kind of acknowledging the experiences my body was going through. But like I said, I was in so much shock. The pain wasn't really that great, but at the time, I thought, you know, this is it. Check, please, on this life. And I thought, you know, this is how I die. This is a stupid way to die. But I kind of accepted that was what was happening, and that was what was going on. And I looked at my life and what I wanted to do with my life, my goals and dreams at the time, and it didn't seem that important. It seemed like, okay, I'm ready to go on. But what really made me change my mind about that was when I didn't think about myself and I didn't think about my goals and dreams, which really didn't matter. But when I started to think of my wife and my little baby girl, who was only about 6 months old at the time, and I thought of my stepdaughter, whose father had kind of stepped out of her life and didn't want to have anything to do with her, and now she was about to lose another dad. And you know, when I started feeling for them, and I knew what they were going to experience with, you know, by me not being there, and it made me mad that this was being taken away from them, that I wasn't going to be able to be there for them. And I turned that anger into a positive energy. I turned it into, I'm not going to allow this to happen. I'm not going to leave. And I think it was completely up to me at that moment. I think, you know, the realization that you know, the things that we plan for ourselves, the things that we have in mind for ourselves aren't that important. What's really important in this life is what we leave behind in the way of memories and what we do for other people to help create those positive memories and do those positive things for other people.
Right. Well, now, you had 20,000 pounds settle on you. Was this, without going into detail then, was this a work-related accident or was it?
It was. I was working at Walt Disney World at the time, and we were planting trees.
Oh, my goodness.
They sent me up to the top of this little hill to uncover a hole that had been dug weeks before in anticipation of these trees arriving. And so they dug the holes, and they covered them with a piece of plywood. So yeah. I went up the hill, and I took the plywood off, and here's these tiny little frogs sitting down the bottom of this hole. So I thought, I'll jump down there and throw these little frogs out of there so they don't get crushed by this tree. And I did that, tossed all the little frogs out. Jumped out just in time for them to boom this tree out over the top of my head. And basically the operator got in a hurry. He didn't put down the stabilizers on the equipment. So when he boomed out with all that weight on the end of it, it caused the machine to tip over. The back wheels came off. You know, he started yelling, "Look out, look out!" And I, you know, the first thing is like, "Oh, he's messing with me. He's joking." You know? And then it's like, "Oh no, no, this is not a joke." And looking around for a place to jump out of and get out of the way. And next thing I knew, my hand just came up automatically and kind of blocked. You know, I tried to block the machine with one hand and ended up with a broken wrist and getting knocked to the ground. And then I tried to roll out of the way, and which turned out to be a good thing that I did manage at least half a roll, because if it had come down with me flat on my back, it definitely would have killed me.
Okay.
But on my side, it provided a small amount of protection to my internal organs and stuff. Not much. I found out later after I came to in the hospital that a lot of interesting coincidences took place. I remember laying on the ground thinking, you know, when I got hired on at Disney, they told me that their emergency response team had the best response time in the world. And I remember thinking, they're going to have to break their record or I'm not going to make it.
Was it good?
They were really amazing.
Okay. All right. It's good to hear that, you know, because we hear things about Disney that aren't always so good because it is a corporation and things, but it's good to know that they actually are on top of things like that, which, people don't think about that. When you think about Disneyland, and you said this was Disney World, right?
Right.
But you think that, I mean, it's all just fun games, and you don't think about how dangerous some of these things can be for the workers,
sure.
Getting all of this ready for the tourists to come. But
right.
Well, how long were you in the hospital? How long were you actually out of it? How long, I mean, how did they get you, your heart started again? What?
Well, they put me in an ambulance, and I was only on it for like a minute, and then I was on a flight for life. I was told the accident happened at 11:45, and I was in surgery by 12.
Wow.
Disney to Orlando Regional Hospital in 15 minutes, I was in surgery. There was a surgeon who operated on me who was not supposed to be there that day. He's their top, best heart surgeon, best people. He was supposed to be off fishing that day, but does happen to come in at that particular moment just to see what was happening before he went off fishing and saw the emergency. He scrubbed, and they said his hand was inside my chest when my aorta broke loose from my heart and just put blood around. So they said he had to attach the aorta, and at that point, they did everything they could for me. You know, work on the heart and the collapsed lung and everything else, the ruptured diaphragm. They gave me about a 5% chance to live at that point. And then I was in the hospital total about 3 months before I saw my house again.
Wow. Well, I bet that was quite a day. You said that because a lot of people say that they see the white light, they see like the white hallway or a big white room, and they talk to God or they see Jesus so like you had nothing like that.
No, the closest thing to that was everything became very white as I was laying there on the ground before they got the machine off me, but at the point where I was pretty much accepting that this was going to be it. It seemed like everything around me took on like a very white glow, a very white light behind everything.
Okay, yeah. Well, then after you came out of this, and you were, like you said, in the hospital for 3 months, but you were totally coherent and everything for that time. I mean, it was, you had the heart surgery, and then they started patching up everything else, which
right.
seems like a lot they had to patch. But what did you notice, like your feelings start to change or anything from the way they'd been before?
You know, the couple of the things that I do remember is that I think because of the morphine and everything, I seem to have like dreams where I would wake up, and then when I would fall back asleep, I would pick up right exactly where the dream left off, and it just seemed like endlessly dreaming the same sort of dreams and stuff. And a lot of it was just really strange. I don't know other words to describe it. They were bizarre dreams. There were dreams where I could just kind of feel my body spinning and spinning. I just slowly started, you know, getting better out of that, being able to be a little more coherent. At first, it was really difficult to. I couldn't speak. I had a trach tube in my throat, so I had to try to write anything, kind of messages to my wife, and I found it really disturbing that I didn't seem to be able to write. My mind was racing a thousand times faster than my hand would allow me to go. So my handwriting was terrible. My spelling was ridiculous. It's like, what are you trying to tell me here, honey? I can't read this. You know, it would frustrate me that I couldn't communicate.
Sure. For those of us who are communicators, that's really rough. I've never been to the point where I couldn't. I have had stuff down my throat and all, but I managed to get out what I really needed to. But afterwards, now, you know, you've written, like you told us about the Wolf Battle books, and you've written other things. You've done poetry, a children's book. Were you doing much writing before this accident took place, Manuel?
Well, I started off at a very young age doing a lot of writing and stuff. I never really tried to get it published or anything, but it was always kind of a dream of mine from the time I first started reading books and stuff. I kind of went from Dr. Seuss straight into Edgar Rice Burroughs and in literature, so
yeah.
I decided at an early age I wanted to write.
Okay, so you were always writing, but now then this has this accident over two decades ago has maybe I'm sure it's made you appreciate life more and all this. But like you mentioned, there were several coincidences, which of course we say there's no such thing as a coincidence.
Uh-huh. Right.
Like the surgeon. I mean, the best surgeon possible came in on his day off on his way to fishing just to say hi to everybody at the hospital, and there you were. So
right.
Things like that, then don't you start getting that feeling that, wow, I was saved for something. There's
a synchronicity in these sort of things and really in everything in life. And there were so many amusing things that, through all of this dark times and all the pain and stuff, one of the things, my wife came to me and she asked me if I saw anything and if I, you know, went to the other side and all this. And being that I'm a smartass and I've got a sick sense of humor, and even though I was in the hospital at the time and undergoing all this dumb time, I told her, yes, I saw a light and I went towards it and I saw Jesus and God and Joseph Smith. My wife's a Mormon.
Ah, okay. I know that. Okay.
Told her that faith told me that I had to go back. I had to live on and tell all the Mormons that you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. And then I was yanking her chain, and she thought, oh, he's feeling better. He's cracking jokes.
Okay. Yeah. It's like, yeah, if you're cracking jokes about religion and about your wife's religion, it's like, okay, you're feeling better. But,
right. I remember watching a TV show in the hospital also, and I could relate to the guy. They were showing this guy. He had been bit by a poisonous snake in Australia, and I completely understood his sentiment, because he said he was laying there in the hospital. He's recuperating from this poisonous snake bite. He said, everybody keeps telling me, oh, what you know, you're so lucky that the Lord is so wonderful. The Lord saved you. And I thought, you know, if the Lord's so bloody wonderful, why did he let me get bit by that bloody snake in the first place?
Well, I just have to say, you were fortunate. You had some kind of choice on your TV. With my last major surgery, the hospital, everybody there, my doctors, I mean, fabulous, fabulous. But their TV system sucked. In the middle of the night, I could Korean soap operas.
Oh,
and,
no.
Yeah. I actually started watching them. And it was like, this is strange. But I also one time saw a show. It was one of those cooking traveling shows where these people were going around and they were showing different strange restaurants. I got the night that they were showing this restaurant that had 32 different animal penises that you could eat. So, you
know, wonderful.
my idea of TV, I don't have TVs at home, and that would have stopped it anyway. It was like, you know, it was bad. But you had good ones. But, and well, thank you so much, because you have just been cranking out now these books, and I think that's good, and I think that that has to be, and I'm sure you think so too, one of the reasons that you were saved and needed to carry on. So,
well, I think I've got a few things to say and some stuff I want to leave behind in this world that will be good for, maybe it'll help some people, they can pay it forward, and so I want to, that's what I want to do with it.
Right. I think that's wonderful, and even though I know that we have these so-called coincidences happen in our life all the time, and I love to hear about it, because you know you can look back and you can say, oh my God, if that wouldn't have happened, if he wouldn't have been there, if this wouldn't have happened,
right?
And you know, a lot of us who've had life-threatening experiences, we look back and say, well, it's not that I want to ever relive that, but I'm grateful for it because it totally changed my life. And
absolutely.
I think, yeah, so that's a very good thing. So thank you, my friend, for sharing with us so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. We'll talk later then. Okay.
All right. Have a great Thanks much. You have a good day.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello, Ms. Sarit.
Hi. How is everyone doing?
Oh, wow. I actually sneezed during the first part of the show. It's like, what brought that on? I don't have cold, but it's chilly here. So maybe it was just, I don't know, dust flying through. But I know so much has been happening in the Middle East.
I know.
It's so sad. Do you want to start out with some of the things?
Sure.
So much, yeah.
First of all, there's new testimonies from Breaking the Silence. Dozens of testimonies on the Breaking the Silence has a website or Facebook page, and you can find the testimonies on my wall. Apparently, there's no way to actually describe what a society goes through under in military occupation, but the testimonies of the soldiers are shocking, chilling, and horrific to hear. The soldiers admit to the fact that they are never going to recover the bad things that they had to do, that in order to fit in, the girls want to fit in with the men in the Israeli army, so the yes. way they do it is by being really mean to the Palestinians. A lot of the girls say so. There's a lot of daylight robbery going on. Everyone passes the checkpoint. You can take from them whatever you want, and everyone does. That means when they serve in the West Bank, a soldier can go into any shop and take for free whatever they want. People are seriously afraid of the soldiers. The soldiers are afraid of their friends because everyone is so cranky. The people who work in the checkpoints get four-hour shifts. That means they never get to sleep more than 3 hours in weeks and months.
You're kidding. Wait a minute. They're at the checkpoint for 4 hours, and then they're off for four, and then they're back on for four?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes, and they're so cranky. And on purpose, they pick people from the lowest socioeconomic background. also the Palestinians will suffer. They just...
Sure, it's that bully thing. Then. You pick people who are more apt to be bullies, and then you deprive them of a real night's sleep for months on end.
Absolutely. When I was in... I was deprived, too, in basic training. It was horrific.
Wow. Yeah, I did not know that. 4 hours on and 4 hours off. That's, that's a horrible thing to do to anybody. I mean, that. So, see, they're being violated by the government also. I mean,
yes.
The soldiers. So...
there's no rules during war in IDF. The only army rules of 6 hours sleep are only for peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they told us when we asked for 6 hours sleep in basic training. They said, no, that's for peacetime. We're not peace right now. No sleep.
They're never at peace. I mean, they've always got to go around finding somebody to pick on. Well, go ahead.
It's so easy to find someone to pick on in military occupation. I can tell you more about that.
Well, sure.
You just pick on anyone. And
yeah.
Impunity is unbelievable. For example, a testimony of a soldier girl, first time in Hebron. She's terrified, first time patrolling. So in order to make her feel safe, her officer goes and beats up an old man. Then she's horrified, shocked, and scared, asked him why. He said, well, it's better that we beat them up than they beat us up.
Yeah, like the old man was going to attack him. I mean, he was just a bully, and he was trying to impress a young girl. So
yeah.
That's just disgusting. That's, but...
There's dozens of testimonies of beatings just because they can.
Mm-hmm. Because you start out with people who maybe... inclined to be bullies anyway, but even if they weren't, by the time they're through with the propaganda and all in basic training, a lot of them have become bullies or just afraid not to. I mean, they may not be a bully themselves, but they're afraid not to behave poorly. Because
a lot of people think they're going to be moral soldiers, but I've spoken to a Vietnam vet who explained it to me. Very well. He was very sad about his past. But anyway, it's once you see your best friend get killed, you lose it.
Yeah. And
that's how he explained it. His best friend got shot. That's it. He lost it and started shooting back like crazy.
Yeah.
You just go through a psychosis.
The IDF soldiers don't even have that excuse. I mean, that might, because that's not a reason, but that's a poor excuse, but Vietnam soldiers could use that, but the IDF, they can't because very few of their friends have ever even been attacked.
That's
exactly what
I was thinking as I was saying it. I think there are people that I heard that died in IDF, but I think it's not all from enemy fire. A lot of it friendly.
Well, there again, that's something that any kind of army has that, well, they take that risk, and they totally accept it. They call it collateral damage, oh well. Friendly fire, instead of calling it, saying, hey, we murdered our own people, they call it friendly fire.
It's a terrible term.
It is. There's nothing friendly about being shot at. Absolutely nothing. But they try to whitewash the terms. The term, I don't know if you know what wet work is. This is something the governments use police forces, whatever, when somebody goes in maybe to assassinate somebody, instead of saying, so-and-so went in and murdered some innocent person, they just said, well, he does the wet work or something like that. And, that wet work being blood kind of thing. They use words in ways that they were never meant to be used, just so that the rest of us don't get it. I saw something today or yesterday about the Army going in and doing maneuvers in the Palestinian farmland.
Oh, yes. Yep. We need to talk about that.
Yeah, they're tearing up.
I was amazed.
It's not like there's that much farmland left and for the Palestinians, and yet they've got crops growing. And then here come these huge tanks and things just ruining the crops. And
three army tanks.
Yeah. And the tanks...
Damaging harvest.
Well, and you know, the other thing that does, because they're so heavy, it compacts the ground. And so when they want to farm that again, they're going to have to go through all that.
Yes, tilling.
Tilling and things, yeah. Then they would have had to do if it hadn't been.
You know what amazed me?
What? The whole thing amazes me. What? I'm sorry.
Several Palestinians stopped it by standing in front of it.
What courage. Really.
Yes.
And that's really courageous because we know that the IDF is under no, they have no qualms about killing people. So for you to just go out there and stand there knowing that they may just run you over, that's...
Absolutely. They don't really see the Palestinians as real human beings. They see them not even as even animals they like more. They have a lot of protests for veganism,
Well, yeah, I mean, that's so, it's so, and it's probably not the exact same people either. Let's get real. I mean, but it may be some of the same.
No, it's not.
Some. But, you know, it's right, because the country is, for a small country, there's a lot of vegans, a lot of activity. And so you think, great, they value life. And then you look at the government, which is the furthest thing from life valuing.
They really hate their government, I must say.
I could understand that. I totally can understand that.
My 600, 700 Israeli friends just are really good people. I'm starting to wonder how many... Well, what's the percentage of right-wing in Israel? You know, elections are always stolen by the ones who have money.
Yes.
If people in Israel knew the truth, I believe they would all agree with human rights.
I think more would. I mean, there would still be a few who don't get it, just like in this country. But I think that so many more, if they actually understood what's happening and the whole... the causes, and I mean everything, if they understood the whole picture, I have such faith really in humankind that I believe that they would understand and do the right thing if they had all the facts. But, you know, that's hard for them to come by when they're being propagandized like mainstream media does here. So it's up to alternative media. You got to get out there and, you know...
That's the way they keep us ignorant with the wrong facts, or they keep us dumbed down. Wrong facts.
The wrong facts.
In fact, they
may take something that has a little bit of truth in it, and then they're going to skew it all around. You know,
totally.
But we know that in Gaza there's a 300 meter no man's land. It's called no go land. Where from the walls, the towers and the walls, and where the people can farm. And there's 300 meters. So people don't go into that because they're be shot at, right? I mean, okay,
yes.
We get that. So Monday, 500 or 600 meters from the wall, the towers, several men were salvaging just basically trash, but stuff that they might be able to use or sell or trade. And this one man was shot in the foot. Now remember, he's twice the distance that he's supposed to be. He wasn't in the no-go land. He's way away from it. He was shot in the foot. He was only out there like 10 minutes. And he got shot. And they took him by donkey cart to where they could get him in an ambulance, which took him to the hospital. And he was very fortunate, actually, because the bullet went through his foot, that it didn't hit anything major. So they bandaged him up and fixed him, and he was out that same day. But I think this is so horrible, because 300 meters, that's bad enough. I mean, that's all the farmland that they can't use. But then when he's even further away, they just target practice. And nothing's going to be done to that soldier. He might, you know, get slapped on the back and somebody might buy him a beer. But
nothing.
But
Breaking the Silence was talking about killings. One soldier apparently shot at a demonstrator against the order to shoot, and they punished him by just moving him to a different base, which is no punishment at all.
Exactly. Well, you know what? That sounds like what the Catholic Church used to do.
It does.
Doesn't it? When they would have a priest that was a pedophile, they would just move him to another parish and not even tell the people where he was going that they were moving him because of that, and because they just tried to keep shuttling him around instead of doing, and that's what that sounds like.
Absolutely.
Just take him to another area so he can do the same thing. That's
we have an Israeli politician going to jail.
Well, what brought that on?
Taking bribes.
Okay. Not because he's a complete asshole and immoral and on, but...
Exactly,
well,
for the wrong thing. He needs to go for war crimes. His name is Omeret. I don't know how to say it in English, either a president or prime minister, because I hardly know the difference between the two. Sorry about my ignorance. But yes, he's going to jail. So I saw the Israeli papers already joking about, because they have like a few politicians in jail, and they're so much making fun of the jail, having the Knesset move to jail.
It'll be like the country club jail, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to, it's not what we would call hard time. I mean, he'll be there. He'll just be doing whatever he does. And while it's wonderful that he's going to jail, just for corruption, is not, he should be tried for war crimes. Yeah. It's, we rejoice that he's going to jail. And, you know, better that than nothing, I guess. But war crimes would be a real good charge. Have you heard anything, Sarit, this week about the mosque?
They went into the mosque today. Settlers with soldiers.
Oh.
Yes, I heard they went in today. They call it showing presence. What it is if there's nothing to do, there's a thing called showing presence, according to the testimonies, where they just go and show their presence. Part of showing presence is also doing home incursions.
Okay. So it's more harassment and just trying to keep people frightened. It's a psychological thing.
They deeply believe that area, that all it belongs to them, and that the Palestinians are not, they're just Arabs and they can go live anywhere in the Arab world and be fine.
They don't
understand. It's like you're saying they're a French person, move to Europe, you'll be fine, you're European. They don't get it.
Exactly. In any area, wherever, just get them there. Yeah. They don't want to get it either. I mean,
really need to understand is when a person loses their home and livelihood and they become poor and homeless, that's terrible. They don't seem to get that the sadness of it, I guess.
No, they don't, because there again, they've labeled them as subhuman. So it doesn't really matter.
And it's true, they did. I've had some Israelis tell me that Jewish people have a higher soul.
Really? A higher soul?
A higher soul or a different soul?
Oh, my God.
It's really sad to hear it.
And they believe that.
Oh, they believe it so bad. I can tell they feel horrified that I married a non-Jew. They're horrified, I can tell.
Oh.
They think he must be a terrible asshole because of it. Who knows? Funny and sad.
They should be as good a person as your husband. They give it a try sometimes. You know, he tries to be fair and he checks facts and everything, and those people do nothing like that.
Talmud says so.
I wonder if it's like the because you know there's some Christians that think, well, like the one wayers that think, you know, their way is the only way or the only right way. I wonder
yeah,
if it's
we have that.
Kind of an attitude, you know, those people they make it to heaven, but they're not going to sit at the right hand of God or something. You know, it's there's going to be a class. System.
Oh,
like
yeah. Today, one of the biggest rabbis in Israel declared to a city not to rent apartments to lesbians.
Ah!
So I asked, what about rapists? Because I know the country's plagued by rape and any other violent crimes. But no, he's bothered by the existence of lesbians, which is the most harmless people I've ever met.
Yeah, the only... I've seen some of the women in horrible fights only with each other. And I mean that was, you know, a rarity kind of thing, but no, they're not bothering anybody. They don't want to bother anybody. They don't want to be bothered. They'll pay their rent.
I told him to have a big protest underneath his house, a kissing.
Oh. Yeah, well that
they said yes.
Well, he'll probably have a heart attack, and then they'll be charged with murder. So you want to go eat?
I tell you, that would be incredible if they do it. I will share it with you all.
Oh yeah,
it's time to engage in more direct actions. If people in my town were more interested, we would do more. But it's very hard to get people here out of their homes.
Well, now the weather's getting better. I say that on a pretty cold day here right now. And it's not cold. It's just that it's been up to 90 and now it's in the 50s, so it feels cold. But the weather is getting better. So do you think that Tennessee is going to get out there more when the weather is?
Yeah, there's more on Mondays and there is all kinds of little organizations. What we need to do is unite, have solidarity between all the struggles and unite for one big one instead of having 1,000 small fights. We should show our power numbers by uniting more often. I believe it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's that we can unite over, and then once we get that under control, then we can have our own whatever. I mean, even it's important to us, but it's not maybe world changing right now. The climate change is very important, in my opinion, because if we don't do something about that, we're not going to be here to worry about all this other stuff. So
I know, and there's people who still wonder if they should believe in it or not. Since when do we argue so much with so many scientists?
Yeah, but
since the beginning of time, actually. Since they said the world is round and not flat.
Yeah. Well, and now, you know, but these people are saying that the sun goes around the earth, not the earth around, you know, there's, and in this country, they're trying to take out a lot of science courses in schools because they don't want the kids to learn the truth. So, I don't know. I mean, the science.
I know. They teach creationism at school here.
Yeah. And they've said now that the teachers, I don't think it's in Tennessee. I think your husband told me. It was in Tennessee. The teachers can teach creationism if they want. They don't have to, but they can if they want. They can teach it as a science.
Yes, so, absolutely. Tennessee is one of them where
yeah.
it passed. I went to the protest when it passed, and I thought I would see a bunch of angry people. There was maybe 30 people, and I was the most angry. I found myself yelling at the building.
Okay, well, keep yelling, because it's...
Not
it's,
yelling, but
no,
fretting,
no. Yeah.
Talking a lot.
Yeah.
I'm usually very quiet.
And, yeah, you for a quiet person, you manage to get your thoughts known. So
I believe we must. I don't
yes.
know why. I think, what's the point of life if we have all these thoughts and never share them?
Exactly. It's like not really living. You're not being authentic. You're not doing something you believe in. And so that's just surviving, really, I think. It's not really living.
It's, yeah, and I hurt when I see what's happening all around us.
I know. No. And that,
I suffered from injustice a lot.
Well, that's the humaneness in you. You know, and everybody has that, but some people have had it so blocked off or they're in such denial. Because there again, they a part of them understands that if they admit it, it's their responsibility to do something, but they don't want to do anything, or they're afraid that they can't make a difference, kind of thing. So
I don't even know if I don't think, sometimes I don't believe I can make a difference. Sometimes I know every little thing we do makes a difference. We just never really know what it is.
Exactly. That's it. You never know what line or phrase or incident you're going to talk about that is going to click in somebody else's brain. And so you just keep going on. And
we're
then,
like farmers.
Pardon?
We are like farmers.
Yeah, exactly. Just keep planting. And, you know, you never know. Just like in the bad weather. Like now here, we can't even till up our ground because it's too wet. But there's some of the farmers have tried, and they've tried to do a little planting and things. And, you know, some of it's going to actually grow, but then they're going to have to go back and redo a lot. But, you know, they're just doing it because that's what we do. And we know that there will be some good come from it. So I'm pretty optimistic still. But I'm like you. I have those moments when I read something.
I have a lot of friends in Gaza lately, and they're really sweet and kind. And I just like to say that their water is unfit for human consumption. 90% of it. There are 1.7 million people there right now.
And some of them are not eating every day. I want to make that perfectly clear too, because of the fact that they can't grow crops in a lot of that no-go land, and the tunnels to Egypt have been shut down. They're firing on the fishermen still. So I have a friend that they don't eat every day. And to me, that is just, oh, my God. How do
I know,
you...
and the land of milk and honey, that anything grows in it, land of plenty, they managed to do that. And I want everyone to know the sewer water from the settlements is going through Palestinian villages. All the toxic sites are next to Gaza. What they're doing is very slow genocide, really.
It is. And then in Gaza itself, the infrastructure is shot. So like we had a few months ago, all that rain, and then, you know, sewage was just everywhere in the streets because the infrastructure is bad. So you put that together with just the contaminated water anyway. And like you said, in the settlements in the West Bank, it's just, the sewage, the settlements, they have all the water they need for their swimming pools and everything. But if you're
by the way, if I want to buy a house in the settlements, it would be very cheap.
Yes, right, because you have Jewish blood.
And an Israeli citizenship. I haven't renewed it, but I could. Yes, it would be very cheap for me. Right. Much cheaper than anywhere else in Israel.
Yeah.
Palestine.
Get around those people and, you know, learn more hate and things. But, Sarit, I'm going to let you go and keep up the good
work.
Yeah,
we just touched the tip of the iceberg here. There was
definitely
really a lot more going on every day than we even
failed to mention.
We would need hours.
Yeah, but please, go to Breaking the Silence on Facebook and the website and the YouTube. Breaking the Silence.
Yes, amazing.
Brave soldiers are speaking out. So we highly support them. So thank you so much.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening, and welcome to Feed Your Head. Tonight's guest is David Williams from Round37.com. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, well, I was just telling them I'm a little chilly. It got in the 50s, and it feels like 30s, you know, because it was warmer earlier. So it's like, okay, whatever. But speaking of cold, we're talking about the Cold War.
Oh, what a lead-in.
Yeah, well, it's just what a segue, yeah. Well, it's funny, today online you put the picture with the coat and all, like you're getting ready for it. So it's like, I got it. Anyway, my friend, you have been interested in the Cold War for quite some time, I believe, right?
Yes, I have. Probably since mid-80s, maybe later 80s. You know, I started reading, you know, the spy novels, and then I got more into the factual evidence of it in books. And then I started collecting memorabilia, and, you know, I got pieces of the Berlin Wall and some various other Soviet items and, you know, a few papers from the Manhattan Project and stuff like that. So, yeah, pretty good collection.
What was the fascination?
You know, that's a good question. I think the fascination was born out of fear. You know, I used to hear about the the air drills and stuff like that, and in our town we would have the sirens, and then, you know, I remember one time in particular when I was a kid, I was sort of coming home on my bicycle, and I'd heard the siren going off, and, you know, I didn't know if it was like a tornado siren, I'm, you know, here in Oklahoma, or if it was like a, you know, nuclear event siren or something like that, and, you know, it just got me thinking about it, and then it sort of sparked a curiosity, and then the more I researched it, it seemed like the more absurd it got, you know, you know, one of my favorite movies is Dr. Strangelove because it's brilliant in its satire on the whole comedy of the reality of the Cold War and how it got to such a point, I guess, with the climax of, you know, perhaps the Cuban Missile Crisis or even later in, you know, and a lot of people don't know about this, in 1984 with the Abel Archer event, and, you know, I might discuss that a little bit later, but you know, there's several events that we came so close to destroying ourselves.
Right.
And for what? You know, 50 years from now, you know, the communist capitalist thing is probably going to be so moot as like some 17th century medieval, you know, serf system,
right,
or something. It's just going to be, and the fact that we were willing to destroy the world over that, it's, you know, it doesn't follow any kind of logic to me, and it's just absurd. And that's the curiosity that was born of that absurdity.
Well, you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was in the 60s, I think. The Cold War, as such, supposedly started either near the end of the Second World War or right after, as I understand.
Well, I can actually tell you what a lot of people consider the very moment that the Cold War started, and that was when we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Dropping that bomb on Hiroshima, in my opinion, that was completely unnecessary. And right. My opinion follows with a lot of other people's opinions, like Eisenhower, General LeMay, Nimitz, the naval admiral. I mean, there was a lot of people in power that considered it completely unnecessary. But it was necessary in the way that it was making a statement towards the Soviet Union that, look, we have this power now. We're going to be the ones that are in control of the world.
Yeah. So, okay, that makes sense. And
then right after that, there was an official policy that was started by us. It was a State Department analyst called George Kennan. He wrote something called the containment theory, and it sort of followed along with later the domino theory, that it was in the U.S. interest to contain the Soviet Union after World War II.
Ah, right, because it was not, even though we were allies with the Soviet Union in the Second World War, it was not a pleasant end to the war. And in fact, like when we brought we being the United States, brought a bunch of the German scientists and things over, they wanted to come here because they didn't want to go to the Soviet Union, but yet we divided Germany, Germany and Berlin right down, to the east and the west. And so there was a lot of spying and espionage and things concerning Germany, I know, during this whole time.
As far as the Cold War goes, Berlin could probably be considered the epicenter of everything. It was one of the hottest spots. You had the Checkpoint Charlie, and then you had the Berlin Wall that was dividing East and West Germany, and a lot of the spying and activity like that. The East Germany had the Stasi, and a lot of that spying and stuff was centered in Germany. As a matter of fact, we had a secret tunnel that we dug underneath from West to East Germany that we used to spy on East Germans.
Wow.
We actually tapped into their telecommunications. It was eventually discovered by because of a spy in England that revealed it. But yeah, there's just so many stories like that are incredible that you start reading about it. And you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. A lot of people don't realize how close we actually came to World War III and complete destruction. It probably came down to the decisions of one or two people that prevented it.
Yeah.
There was this Soviet submarine commander that was, I think his name was like Vasily, I forget what his name was, but the submarine was equipped with nuclear torpedoes, and we were dropping depth charges on it, and they had orders to use the torpedo, and one of the commanders overruled that order. And of course, if they had used the nuclear torpedo, it would have been the end, because we would have retaliated, and
sure.
It would have been basically the.
There have been people with sense throughout the ages.
Another curious fact I might bring up about that Cuban Missile Crisis, and it has to do with Kennedy. Kennedy, when he was campaigning against Eisenhower, he had his campaign slogan against Eisenhower called the Missile Gap. He was blaming Eisenhower for allowing this huge missile gap between the Soviets and the United States. He was saying that, Kennedy was saying that the Soviets had so many more missiles than we did, and it was because of Eisenhower that we got to this point. Well, it turns out when Kennedy got in office, he found out it was completely the opposite. The missile gap was there, but it was us. We had, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had 400 intercontinental ballistic missiles, and Russia had 4. So what was happening was Khrushchev, because he didn't have these ballistic missiles that could go from Russia to the United States, he tried to install these, they call it medium-range missiles, okay? So he could, like, at least have something to back up his bluff. And so Castro, after he'd just gone through the Bay of Pigs, he said, well, why don't you put your military bases here? You can install these intermediate range missiles, and it'll allow you to have some sort of parity with what Kennedy was saying, because once Kennedy found out that he had all these missiles, he was actually bringing it up and sort of forcing the issue towards the Soviets. And so Khrushchev agreed, and then it got discovered.
Right.
So in a way, Kennedy caused the Cuban Missile Crisis, but he also got us out of it. So, there was a couple of things there that sort of counteracted each other.
That people don't really know that much about. I was going to ask you, that movie, wasn't it 13 Days? What was it called?
Was
that movie pretty close, you think, or...
It had the basic gist of it. It sort of presented the general feeling of the seriousness of it.
That was it. I mean,
one of the huge things that was a mistake was, they had the U-2s flying over Cuba and discovered these missiles. Okay, and then it shows in the movie that they had these experts that came in and identified the missiles of what they were. Well, that was sort of the public perception of what happened. What actually happened was there's a Soviet colonel that was a spy for us, and he actually gave us top secret information that allowed us to identify those missiles. He later got discovered. His name was Oleg Penikovsky. And he later got discovered about it, and they basically cremated him alive for it.
Okay.
So he paid a dear price for it.
Yeah, I've never understood, because I've read a lot of those spy novels too, and watched some of those espionage movies and things, and it was just I wondered about the people who actually would do all of this spying. It's like, did they have such faith in their particular governments? Was it the excitement? Was it, some of them made money, not that many of them, I think, not that much. I mean, what caused people? Were they just...
Well, some of them did it for belief, and some of them did it for money. There was a lot of spies on our side that delivered secrets, and they got paid money.
Yeah.
But there was... four British double agents that revealed a lot of information about, I mentioned that tunnel that was underneath Berlin, but they mentioned a lot of other things. It was called the Cambridge Four, I think. But anyway, there was four of them that were deeply involved in spying for the Soviets. But, it was like spy versus spy, back and forth.
Well, and a lot of what
eventually,
did they
after the Cuban Missile Crisis, both leaders on the side. Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis caused Khrushchev to be thrown out of power, but both sides realized that they came so close to destroying the world that they had to sort of cool it a little bit, and then that got to the point where they tried to get a little bit of arms control, and they started the test ban for. Above ground test ban, and they installed the hotline and all these other things. Everybody sort of realized that have to start making some changes, or they're on the course of apocalypse. So
Right. Well, I mean,
then, in the 80s, when Ronald Reagan came around, he sort of changed things again, and he sort of, I don't know, he was like he's living back in the 50s and 60s, and he started ramping up the pressure back on the Soviets, and they started a psychological operation against the Soviets, and that sort of peaked right about 1982. And back then, they had Brezhnev. He was convinced that the United States was going to do a preemptive strike on the Soviets, and so that they started this program called Program Ryan. And what it was they're going to have all their spies across the world look for signs that the United States was going to do a first strike. They seriously thought that the United States were going to do a nuclear first strike, and so they had all these agents looking for this list of signs that said, okay, if these signs occur, the first strike is imminent. And so going through looking for all these strikes. And so at the same time, Ronald Reagan was ramping up this pressure to the Soviets, and it got to be really bad. They would do like these psychological operations where they'd have these fighters that would fly over to the border of the Soviets and at the very last second turn around and do all this sort of provocative stuff. And then it sort of peaked when NATO did this operation called, it's like a big military exercise. It's called April Archer. And what they did is they went through all this sort of maneuvers, and it just so happens that all these maneuvers fulfilled all the clues that the KGB was looking for that says there's going to be a first strike.
Oh, and they did that on purpose? I mean, they knew about
the United States didn't know that the Soviets were so paranoid about this first strike. They didn't know about this Ryan program. And so what happens was, even on this Able Archer exercises, they went through DEFCON 5-1. You know, I don't know if you know what DEFCON means. It's defense condition. You know, it's like the nuclear state of the state, you know. DEFCON 5 is normal, and DEFCON 1 is we're getting ready to launch.
Right.
Well, anyway, during this Able Archer exercise, they went from DEFCON 5 to DEFCON 1, you know, as part of the exercise. So the Soviets thought that a launch was going to happen within hours. And so they fueled up all their missiles. They had all their fighters loaded up. They had everything. You know, it's like fingers were on the trigger. And at the very last second, when they thought everything was going to launch, and the Soviets want to do a first preemptive launch, you know, because if you don't, you know, the other side's going to launch. It's suicide if you don't preempt.
Right.
So they were getting ready to do a preemptive strike. And within a couple hours before the strike, this Able Archer exercise ended. And so they realized that it was just an exercise, and they backed down on all the missiles. But we were in like a couple hours.
My God, I mean, these people, they just like to really, really play games dangerously.
They do. You know, it's and the thing is that even though people think that it's different now as far as the nuclear thing, we still have a couple of thousand missiles aimed, and they have a couple of thousand missiles aimed. So it's sort of the same situation. But, you know, they've sort of backed off. It's not like the Cold War tension now, but it's still, the missiles are there.
Right. And if you look at those maps of where we have missiles, really trying to surround Russia, it's pretty obvious. But did the Cold War really ever end, really?
Yeah, it did.
Did it?
You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it and, you know, Russia sort of had had to regroup, it ended then. I mean, you know, we have tensions now, but it was nowhere near what, you know, nobody in the Russia thinks that we're going to launch missiles at them, and nobody in the United States thinks that Russia is going to launch missiles at it.
Okay.
You know, this Ukraine thing, it's... You know, it's a big screw-up by the United States, in my opinion, a big screw-up.
Oh,
you know, they set up the situation where you know, they supported the oligarchs over there in Ukraine, and then they also have, you know, probably 20% of them are Nazis. And so they did this overthrow, and you know, what do you expect Putin to do but to secure his naval base? So, you know, the Black Fleet is one of the largest naval bases in the world. Of course he's going to secure that in Crimea.
Yeah.
So, I mean, once it's done with that, and, you know, Russia has all the cards now. I mean, they really don't need Ukraine. You know, the gas lines that go through Ukraine have been replaced with a couple of major gas lines north and south of Ukraine. Ukraine owes Russia over $2 billion. You know, so the only thing that NATO and the EU, if they bring in Ukraine with the IMF, is going to be paying Russia's bills. You know, Ukraine is broke. So, you know, they sort of messed up, and they got this big albatross stone around their neck by trying to bring in Ukraine in the EU. And the thing is, it's sort of a bad situation for the population of Ukraine because, you know, they're being manipulated. You know, the United States is trying to do this containment around the border of Russia. In the meantime, you know, Ukraine's broke. They can't get gas. You know, 65% of the gas comes from Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. And now Russia is charging Ukraine $100 more for gas unit than all the rest of the people that they're charging. And, you know, they can't get any loans for this, to pay off this Russian debt that they owe. So, and the IMF, you know, they're like predators. They're going to go and say, here's the money to pay for some of this stuff, but here's the concessions that we demand.
Look at Greece.
Greece. Yeah. I mean, the IMF really is they're like vultures. They're predators.
They are. They are. They go into a country that's already having money issues, and then they tell them they're going to cut all their social services and things and go right on. No, austerity. Yeah. So.
And the poor Ukraine people, they're caught in the middle. I mean, they're the ones that are going to make out terrible in this, you know, either way.
Yeah.
You know, they could have gone back with Russia, but you know, they wouldn't have it over here in the EU and the United States. They had plans for years on how to do this. I forget what's her, Newland or whatever that ambassador was over there that actually got caught on the phone talking about it. But anyway, it wound up pretty bad for them. So it's just the way it is. You know, Russia right now, I mean, they're being the most sane voice in the whole argument, and the thing is they hold all the cards. They, you know, they have the gas, they have everything, and you know, they can just sit and wait. And you know, as far as calling that a cold war, you know, just because Russia's involved any time doesn't mean that it suddenly is a cold war. A cold war is the Cuban Missile Crisis in Berlin and all this stuff, and yeah. You know, missiles raining down upon us and duck and cover and, you know, fallout shelters. That situation in Ukraine is definitely not the Cold War.
Okay, it's just a mess.
It's just a mess, and a mess that we have a lot to blame for. You know, I mean, we probably caused it. So, I mean, you know, Ukraine, they had a lot of corruption, and, you know, the leader over there was really corrupt, but the thing is it went from bad to worse. And, you know, it's kind of like the United States and the EU is looking out for Ukraine.
Yeah, well, the United States got in who they wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't look out for the people. That he's not for the people there. So
no, and the people that are in power now temporarily are looking out for the people. You know, what was that big thing that happened to Odessa? They burned alive those people in the building. Is that the people that we're supporting?
Well, every time you see that around the world where there's been that kind of thing, it turns out it's the people that the U.S. is supporting that are doing. I'm not saying they're the only ones that do horrific things, but things like that, it turns out. So I don't know. No, but you
well,
know.
Well, you know, it went from 1946 when George Kennan came out with his containment plan to bring about democracy across the world, democracy, to we'll support anybody that's anti-communist. And so, you know, we wound up supporting people in South America that were just brutal dictators. And, you know, we wound up supporting people over the world that were just horrendous as long as they remain anti-communist. And, you know, anybody that even had an inkling that going towards socialism, you know, we overthrew. I mean, our history from the 50s on up is a long history of involvement in other countries' governments. I mean, look at Iran. I mean, we're still having repercussions from that when we overthrew their government back in, what was it, 1950-something? 1953?
Yeah. And put the Shah in. Yeah,
put the Shah in. You know, and that's the one thing I wish people had is a more open viewpoint as to who the enemy is, or, you know, if you want to consider an enemy, or who the other side is. You know, I remember when the Iranians held all the hostages, and it's like, here's a bunch of crazy terrorists holding these hostages. Well, nobody were thinking about, okay, here we've been, we overthrew their government, we pay them, you know, nothing for the oil that we're stealing from them, you know, during the Shah years. We were basically raiding their country of every resource they had. And so naturally you would think that they would be upset about it. You know, and other countries, you know, when you bomb the hell out of them, you know, they get mad. Look at North Korea. I mean, we destroyed 25% of their population. We killed them by bombing. You know, we completely firebombed 80 major cities in North Korea.
Could you imagine? And yeah, that people wonder then, well, why don't they like us?
Can you imagine, you know, if 25% of our population in the United States was destroyed by a country, was killed by a country, by bombing, how we would feel about that country? I mean, we still haven't gotten over, you know, something from 200 years ago.
Yeah.
How would we feel about that? But, you know, that's the thing, is I just, it sort of angers me that people have these sort of dogmatic 5-second soundbite reactions to the other side when they don't really do any kind of work to try to figure out, well, how do they get to this point? How do they feel about that? I mean, what caused them to be this way?
Well, that whole thing about looking at it from the other person's view. Yeah, how would we feel if that happened to us? About not doing something you wouldn't want to happen to you, kind of thing, you know. Treat your neighbors
even,
like you did.
What was his name? Oh, Robert McNamara. He had this movie called The Fog of War, and he had a list of like, I think it was like 8 things that you need to, that he learned throughout his sordid career. And you know, one of them was, have empathy for your enemy. Understand your enemy. You know, understand that they may be in a situation where, you know, it's backed them into a corner, or they're feeling, or they're acting this way because of, you know, understand the actions of your adversary.
Well, that's very good advice. I mean,
it is very good advice. Yeah.
Know where they're coming from. And then, though, I think that when that happens, you may find that they're not your enemy anymore. I mean, if you act on what you find.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was part of the Cold War. It was defining, you know, you remember that how they better than dead and red and commies and all this other stuff. And, you know, during the 1950s, you had all this propaganda in the movies and all sorts of stuff. And no, it demonizes these people that, you know, you don't know anything about. You know, and the fact that you're willing to kill millions of people that you've never met, never understand, don't know anything about their culture, you're willing to kill millions of people just because you heard a slogan of better dead than red, or, you know.
Yeah. That's where propaganda enter Zen so much. And we're, well, we're victims of it. We just allow it. And I think
mainstream media
peddles it. So,
and a lot of people don't even realize that we are, you know, swimming in propaganda. That, you know, they, well, how can the United States have propaganda in our population? They just don't realize it. I mean, they're so snowed that they don't understand. You know, they think, well, the mainstream media certainly isn't censored. They can do anything they want to. And,
exactly.
And, yeah. You know, they just don't understand it. They don't see it. They're trying to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and look on the outside when they've never seen anything on the outside. And a lot of them don't even care to try to.
Well, that's the sad part, that they even want to. Wouldn't even want to learn about somebody else's culture or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're completely satisfied with a bumper sticker and maybe a yellow ribbon.
Yeah. That's amazing. I think that was one thing that I can actually say that I grew up in a Baptist church, and I think that was one thing they really, I mean, they got a lot of things right, actually, but they had something in the winter that they would call School of Missions, and it was about 6 weeks. Every Sunday night, they would take a different country or culture or something, and you would get into that. And I remember one time it was the Indians, the Navajos, in the southwestern part of this country. And then it was the Eskimos. And once it was Palestinians. And, you know, that kind of thing. And that was just, for a kid growing up in a little town in the middle of Illinois, that was my first exposure, I mean, it's very young, to other cultures. And whether what they did was right or wrong, it was an entryway for me. So I will always be grateful for that because, I mean,
well, the history of this country is the history of demonizing groups. I mean, you brought up the Palestinians. I mean, when was the last time you heard a Palestinian talking on the news about their condition, about what happens to them?
Only on...
I mean,
it never
happens. It's never happened.
Only for us. Yeah, that's true.
And that's the thing. It's demonizing the person that you're trying to fight or person you're trying to oppress. You know, we demonized the commies back in the 50s. You know, they were hanging out at every corner and, you know, remember the old McCarthy era when they did the House Un-American Activities Committee and you know,
they
blacklisted all these people.
Yeah, movie stars and everything.
Yeah.
Had to be just a horrid time.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan was an informant for that group, by the way.
Oh, well, you know what, that just, doesn't that figure, yes, the man that took the solar panels off the White House.
Yeah, back when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild way back when.
Okay.
So speaking of Ronald Reagan, here's another sort of trivia thing. You know, he, when he became president, he refused to get debriefed about nuclear war at all. You know, he said, you know, why, you know, that's not going to happen, why plan for it, all that stuff. And he refused to have any briefings about, attend any briefings about it. But, and, you know, he was real sort of strategic defense initiative and all this other crap. And he was really sort of pro nuclear weapons. I mean, they even had a point there where they were trying to bring back fallout shelters. But until one event happened and he changed his mind and he actually in Oslo went and tried to enact some strategic arms limitations. And do you know what that one act was that happened that made him change his mind?
What was it?
There's a trivia question.
What happened? I did not realize that he refused to be debriefed even.
He wouldn't even attend the military meetings. The one act that made him change his mind was not any of the facts. He saw the movie the day after on TV. And he was so depressed after that movie that he changed his policy.
Wow.
The movie. You know, I mean, how much of an actor cornball is that if it takes a movie to change your official foreign policy?
Wow. Well, see, that's it. Because movies can be propaganda, too. Recently, I watched the old movie. I think it was from the 50s or 60s, On the Beach. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Oh, yeah. I read the book, too.
Okay.
Was it Rock Hudson or Cary Grant? Cary Grant, I think it was. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but it was a submarine crew, and they were in Australia. And the bomb then, you know.
And dropped, and they had to go back to the United States. And, yeah, I read the book.
They were going back.
When that came out, the State Department produced some talking points on how to debunk On the Beach. It was like, when asked questions about On the Beach, these are the answers that you should give.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a big thing back then, On the Beach.
I have read about it, you know, from time to time. And so I watched it, and oh, my God. That's what I was telling people.
Impressive,
okay, yeah, you better watch
this. They remade that movie, I think, too, On the Beach.
But you know what? When they remake it, I'm sorry. I'm not a big fan of
it. Yeah, it doesn't work.
No.
They had a couple of three movies that were sort of a really affected population. One was, of course, that Dr. Strangelove. And then there was another one called Failsafe. It had Henry Fonda in it. And it was sort of depressing. Not quite as depressing as On the Beach.
I've heard of it. I don't think I've seen it. Failsafe, huh?
Yeah, it came out about the same time that Dr. Strangelove did, and it, you know, Dr. Strangelove came out first and sort of took the wind out of the sails of the other movie, and it wasn't as good anyway, so. But.
Well, one of the things that I still sometimes will watch the, on YouTube, the shows, because there were a lot of TV shows that had, you know, to do with the Cold War. And they had these different wonderful little spy thingies. And I think a lot of interesting things mechanically came out of that period of time.
One of the most interesting things that came out of that was there was a guy in the Soviet Union that you remember the old science fiction movies that had that, you know, that theremin? Remember the theremin, you know, that does that?
No, I never watched very many.
You know,
you
wave your hands over this instrument and it makes these noises, sort of worldly noises.
Yeah, okay.
Well, anyway, that guy, he was really smart. He not only invented that instrument, you know, it became famous and was used a lot in the 70s and 60s in movies and stuff, but he also invented this thing called the Thing. And the Thing was this little strip of metal that was embedded in this wooden, huge emblem that was given by Soviet schoolchildren to the embassy in Moscow. And, you know, these Soviet schoolchildren gave this big wooden plaque to the embassy as like some sort of, stately thing to do. You know, here's schoolchildren giving this. But inside, it had this little tiny strip of metal, okay? And after a few years, the embassy realized that some of their communications were being eavesdropped upon. And they couldn't figure out how it was going. I mean, they would bug sweep their embassy, and they never found any bugs or anything. And so finally they looked at this big emblem thing that had been given by these schoolchildren, and they discovered this little thin strip of metal, and they couldn't figure out what it was, and so they called it the Thing. And what it was they had several hundred yards away, they had this Soviet safe house that would beam this microwave energy at this strip of metal. And then when people talked in the room, that strip of metal would vibrate, and they could receive the microwaves that reflected off the strip of metal, and they could decode what the people were saying in the room by this little strip of metal that they energized. So once they didn't want to eavesdrop anymore, they would just turn off the microwave transmitter, and it was just a strip of metal. You know, nobody would think anything of it. They couldn't figure out how the thing worked for the longest time.
Good heavens.
But yeah, anyway, it became known as the Thing. And the weird thing about it is that same technology later became the basis for RFID tags.
Ah.
Yeah, the little strips of metal, you know.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, that's why I'm thinking that a lot came out from there.
You're right,
that,
yeah.
Right.
From both sides. I mean, you know, a lot of the transistors and, you know, all that stuff, computers and all that stuff were actually being driven by Cold War technology.
Well,
and of course,
and
all that.
Well, now we have those shops in every major city, whatever they're called. I mean, they're basically spy shops where you can buy all this stuff to invade your neighbor's privacy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whoever else
yeah.
is. So
well,
I would
nowadays, assume, by far the biggest spy is the United States.
It's the government.
You know, I mean, they just have all the technology.
Yeah.
They're so far over all the other countries. I mean, they're, you know,
yeah.
magnitudes ahead.
It just seems so immoral. But, okay, so now you're saying there is no Cold War now, and that, I mean, it's just the West trying to do whatever. What do you think about the organization, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China? What do you think about them as a group?
Well, I think the United States will consider them a threat.
Okay.
And also, you know, Russia's trying to get this gas deal. I don't know where it's at right now, but they're trying to get this huge gas deal with China. And, you know, it also has to do with these big pipelines they had. And once they do that, then a lot of the sort of the petro power of the United States and all that sort of goes away. And, you know, it's all this stuff now is – it's because of resources, you know, it's the resources of petroleum or resources of lithium or resources of whatever. It all comes down to the countries fighting for these resources. And, you know, the United States after the Cold War, you know, we were sort of the big bully on the block and we could pretty much command anything. And of course, any country that's starting to develop power, you know, say like Putin or China or something like that, suddenly they become our enemy. You know, it's like a whack-a-mole thing. Whoever pops their head up, we try to slam them down with a little mallet.
So, well, yeah, but that's just the United States being the bully that it has been forever. The things that I wasn't taught in history that I had to figure out.
No,
so, you know, the United States is
well, you know, I mean, the history books in the classrooms are so much devoid of what actually the reality is. It's, you know, I mean, we're always fighting for democracy and, you know, we have slow motion eagles flying overhead and flags waving, you know, and it's not that way. It's a lot more complicated. You know, we're not necessarily the demon of everything, but we're not necessarily the you know,
not necessarily the good guy either.
No. There's a lot of times where we're the bad guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the simplistic view that are forced down people's throats that drives me crazy. And what drives me even more crazy is people that accept it. You know, they don't understand the complications and the nuances. And, you know, I mean, sometimes your country does bad things and how can you change for the better if you don't even realize that they're doing it? You know, if you keep your head in the sand, you know, I think it's our duty as citizens to learn everything, not just the good things.
Right.
We have to learn the bad things, too.
But that people pretty much have to do on their own, or else they get online, get
no,
on
it, I mean, it's not going to be served on a plate for you, of course.
No,
you know,
you're not going to get it in at least grade in high school. Now, some college professors will try, and
yeah,
exactly. Sometimes they put their jobs behind it. Sometimes not, but it depends. But
well, that's where that liberal college stuff comes in. That all the AM radio people complain about, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I can't listen to them very much. I used to listen much more, but somehow I haven't listened for quite a while. And a couple weeks ago, I turned on the radio and I had it on for maybe up to 10 minutes. And
I can't even take it that long.
Bullshit. Yeah, that was five minutes max. It was gone. And I can't even remember now what it was, but it was just flat out lies. And I thought, well, thing is, those particular people, I think they believe what they were saying. And that was so depressing to me that I just couldn't do it.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems to me like that there's always going to be a certain percentage of the population that has a personality that is hateful. I mean, they're just hateful. They are insecure in anything that's different around them, and the only way they can respond to it is hate. And, you know, they wallow in this AM radio, this prideful ignorance, and, you know, they back it up with guns. It's the way it's been in the 50s, you know, with the John Birch Society. It's the way it is with the ranchers that are, you know, trying to protect their cows or whatever you want to call it. You know, it's never going to go away. Prideful ignorance.
I like that phrase a lot. That's what it is. And, yeah, people are quite happy with that. Well, it's something they can deal with. And I think so often deep within people, they understand more, but they're in denial because they fear that once they admit it, it's a responsibility to do something about it. And they either just don't think they've got the time, they don't think they know how, they think they'd be all alone for whatever reason. So they just keep it away. They just deny.
Yeah, they wallow in hate. It's demonizing. You know, I mean, if you ever listen to AM radio, count how many times they say these people or that group or it's if you make the other side subhuman, verifies your hate. It allows it to be
that's what all armies
valid.
Do. Yeah. All armies do that.
They do.
Like here, it's they vilify the little brown people or the ragheads or whatever, but it's them and us.
Yeah, you know the poor people that are lazy it just goes on and on and on. You know, it's demonizing the other side, and in a way, it's a enabling powerful tool. It enables a certain type of people to organize pretty well. You know, I mean, everybody gathers around and circles the wagons with their hate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it feeds then. I mean, you get a bunch of these people together and you can actually feel it because it's so...
Mm-hmm. You can. I mean, it's like you can cut it with a knife. It's just hate, you know. It's like this a lot of this Tea Party stuff. You see these signs and, you know, even the stuff you see in the news, you go to actual event and it's far worse. You know, you just got these demonizing signs that just make other groups subhuman. You know, it validates their hate.
And you know, behind hatred is usually fear in some form. So Are people so afraid that they're going to be treated this way that they have to, it's like I'm down, but I can still find somebody that I can put down. So
you know,
let me do that.
I think it is a lot of that, you know, and I think they have this idealized vision, maybe created by, you know, Hollywood or whatever, you know, how they have like Mayberry RFD, and this is the way America used to be back in the 50s or 60s or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, white America, apple pie, all this stuff. And you see all these other people are as threats to that image, even though the image is not even true. You know, it's
image
the United
never
States
true.
Is immigrants. We consist of immigrants. We always have. You know, and, you know, if you can't accept that fact, then you can't accept America. You know, immigrants built this, you know, the Chinese built the railroads, you know, slave labor built most of the South. I mean, that was their whole economic model was, you know, slaves and you know, if you can't accept that fact as history, then you're just denying yourself and developing a cocoon. Like I said, that validates your hate.
Yeah. So it was just made to order, the actual Cold War, because that was a place, while the Second World War was going on, Americans could hate the Japanese and the Germans, okay? But then once that's done, you've got to have...
Who do we hate?
...place else to throw that hatred. So communism was a good...
Well, you know, I mean, communism certainly, you know, Stalin certainly had...
But that wasn't even communism. I mean, that's the problem.
That was a dictator. You know, and the thing is that as this is going, it got to a point where you have this atomic weapons in the equation, and it just got absurd with this machine that was built to develop all these weapons. I mean, at one time... like 25% of the electricity produced in the United States was used for making atomic weapons. And the Tennessee Valley Authority and Hanford and all these other, 25% of the electricity. Some, I think like 50% of the stainless steel went to developing weapons. You know, I mean, huge amounts of resources, you know, the intellectual drain, the money drain, and it became this vast machine, a monster that, even when people realized in the early 60s and mid-60s that we were going to destroy the earth, we were going to kill ourselves, that it couldn't be stopped. It's, you know, it still can't be stopped. I mean, it's a monster that's out of control. And that monster developed because of hate and insecurity. You know, they develop a weapon and we develop a weapon and we get two of them and they get four of them and the facts rarely enter into the equation at all.
Yeah, facts. What, since you have watched a lot of movies, you're the movie man, what movies do you say are more realistic about the Cold War? I mean, whether they're comedies or dramas, what ones were more realistic about what was really happening, would you say?
Well, there's a paper... I don't know who wrote it, but the title of it was Everything About Mutual Assured Destruction and the Cold War Could Be Learned from Dr. Strangelove. And I believe it.
Really?
Dr. Strangelove has everything. I mean, if you read between the lines. And in fact, that he was able to do it as a dark comedy is a testament to the genius of Kubrick.
But that would be it. We would not go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even Failsafe wasn't that bad. I mean, it actually presented the Soviets as caring about the, you know, their population. But then there's some really bad stuff out there. You know, Red Dawn, stuff like that, just horrendous, stupid.
Well, you mentioned Failsafe portraying the Soviets as caring about their people. I saw something recently, because now it's been, 28 years since Chernobyl, 20-some years, and it was a documentary, and it was much more care and concern in it than I had been led to believe that the Soviets had shown for their country people. I mean, even though that by now I knew that what I'd been led to believe was crock, but it was very touching, and how they really tried to take care of people. And it was true, they didn't talk about it or admit it for a long time, just like the United States doesn't admit all the...
the thing is that, and this cannot be denied, the Soviets were a very secretive society, but look, they had just come off World War II, and if there's any country that defeated the Nazis, it was the Soviets. We didn't win World War II. The Soviets did. The Soviets beat the Nazis, and they lost about 8 million people doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about all the population that were lost and how that would affect a country. you know, a country that's secretive to begin with, and then here right after, you know, there have 8 million or whatever, how many people lost, a major portion of their population, they have another country that's just dropped an atomic bomb, and, you know, their policy is to try to contain you. I mean...
Yeah. A country that supposedly was an ally sort of during the...
is trying to, you know, their official foreign policy is containment. So, you know, you have to look at it from that point of view. And also, you know, during a lot of the 50s, we did a lot of flyovers over the country. We had U-2s flying over the country all the time, you know, mapping their country. And, you know, at the same time, we would have freaked if we had a Soviet aircraft flying over our airspace. But you remember the old times with Eisenhower and Gary Power when he got shot down, and, you know, Eisenhower denied we were doing that, and it turns out that they actually had captured Gary Powers alive, and you had to confess, that, well, that's what we were doing, all right, you know. And
So, I mean, we understand the, like, the government's lie back and forth. I have to tell you, Pinkel said that there were 20 million killed, and some say 26 million.
Of it was starvation, too. I was thinking a lot of it was starvation, and he probably is right on that number, starvation and the population. So,
yeah, so
a lot of them died after what was officially the end of the war, you know. So,
right, but it was,
I mean, how do you count all of them?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's never so simple that it's okay. I went out and shot a person, and that was it. There's more. This person was the sole support of whoever, and so they died because they got no more money for food, and on and on. Yeah, that's very sad. I'm glad to hear that. But don't you think? Okay, we don't have the Cold War going on, but we're doing just as much spying.
The internet has come around. You know, our spying is at an all-time high, of course. You know, and it's so easy. You know, from what the NSA does to, you know, I give you a prime example. You know, one of the things was we were publicizing how countries shouldn't buy Chinese routers because the Chinese were embedding some secretive spy inside their equipment. Well, it turns out that the reason that we were saying that, yeah, here we go. Tufty Cannonball is, he's Pinko's saying 72 million. So it may be true. I mean, I may have severely underestimated, but it was a lot. But anyway, back to the Chinese. Well, what was actually happening was the NSA was getting the press to say that the Chinese servers were infected with this stuff. And the reason they were doing it is because the NSA had infected all of our servers with the stuff, and they were trying to keep the businesses from buying Chinese servers so the NSA could expand the amount of businesses across the world that they could have their hand in.
See? That, yeah, okay. It's never easy. There's always something behind whatever, and that, you know, they always say follow the money. And that's it. Like, at least, you know, look below the surface for everything.
Yeah.
But I would say in the past,
but
definitely
as far as
now.
Spying, you know, as far as the digital world and technology and stuff like that, you know, we, the NSA and the other groups, it's like 26 intelligence agencies, we make the rest of the world look like rank amateurs, to tell you the truth.
Right, right.
We work in everything.
But David, our time is up, and I want to thank you so much.
Great.
I always enjoy having you on because you're so knowledgeable. And, you know, this is, I grew up reading, and I still like to read the spy novels for entertainment. So I'm going to follow Dr. Strangelove, though, since I'm probably one of the few people who's never watched it, and get my ideas.
It's worthy of watching, yeah. I think you can find it online someplace, yeah.
I'm sure going to try. So thank you so much. Until next time,
friend.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.